Yeah, exactly. All right, Reg, you ready to go? Yeah, okay. I like where the levels are. Keep them right there. I'll give you the countdown. I'll give you the three S's. You give me the music, and I'll give you a podcast, right? Okay. Deal? Deal. All right. Put it in the book, episode 255. Wait, what's going on? No sub sandwich today? Okay, I don't know what that hand signal, I don't know what you're trying to do. I'll find out later, I suppose. All right, here we go. Star Smile Strong. Right. You know, you can't do a podcast without that little pep talk you give yourself. So there you go. Star, smile, and strong. Okay, Elton Jim, here we go. Ready? Episode 255, put it in the book. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com, or we are found wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Don't forget, listening is not the only obligation that one enters into when you listen to this podcast. Yes, it's your job to listen every week, and I certainly appreciate you do. But it's also your job to help spread the word. It's a very crowded podcast landscape out there now. Back when I started this, back in 2016, there were a good number, but certainly not like there are now, almost 5 years later, so whatever you can do to spread the word and help me spread the word would be much appreciated. Send a link. Send a message. Talk to your friends. Talk to your family. Whoever you know listens to podcasts on a regular basis, make sure they click in right here. Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Don't forget, if you like what you hear, you go to WGNradio.com. You go to the podcast section. Look for the prompt for this podcast, and you'll find all previous 254 episodes. Not like these upstarts buying a little equipment and saying they got a podcast. This is the real thing. This is the real kahuna. So 254 episodes is proof of that, which, according to my book, can only mean one thing. Welcome to episode 255. So I was thinking about this because over the past week because of a couple of little things I noticed that happened in the world and to me personally. And so I thought it was worth discussing with you folks. And that is, I am happy to say, it's taken several decades, but I am happy to say that for the first time, I believe, since I received my college degree, I can honestly say that it has come in handy. Now, you say, wow, Jim, that's quite a statement. Let me build on that. From the age of 12, and maybe even earlier than that, I knew I wanted to be on the radio. I had been listening to music on the radio for several years before I was 12. I don't know if I knew it was a real job, to be honest with you. I was not one of those young kids that, wanted to grow up to be an astronaut or wanted to be a policeman or wanted to be a fireman. It was never in my, and be a cowboy. I hardly ever played cowboys and Indians. I never played cops and robbers. I don't know. That was just never in my world, in my interest. But I did listen to music at a very young age, and it was a constant companion for me. And I listened to it both buying records as well as obviously listening to the radio. And I can even almost remember the day I always listened to the radio in the morning before I get ready for school. Listening to the songs, listen to music. And I can remember the radio I had. I remember where it was on my dresser. And I remember getting dressed. I remember where I was standing. It's this clear. It's this specific. And one day, I don't even know why I thought of it, but as I was listening to the radio and perhaps listening to the DJ, I would say when I was 12 in the morning, it was a good chance at that time it was probably Bob Surratt on WLS, or it may have been Larry Lujack on WCFL at that time. But whoever it was, that I don't remember. But obviously, but I listened to radio, you know, all those AM music disc jockeys of the 70s in the Chicago area. And I remember getting dressed and looking at the radio, looking straight at the radio and saying, and listening to it, right? And listening to the announcer, the disc jockey talking and saying, that's what I'll do. I don't think I was in any kind of career crisis dilemma, right? I was only 12 years old. But I've always been thinking ahead. I always tell you that I'm always thinking 5, 6, 7 steps ahead. So maybe at that time in my life, I was already wondering, what did I want to be when I grew up? Maybe there was a question in school. I don't know. But for whatever reason, this was on my mind, and I can close my eyes and really picture that moment in my bedroom, getting dressed to go to school, looking at the radio and saying to myself, as I looked at the radio and listened to the announcer saying, I'll do that. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know how one got to do that, but that just sort of stuck in my mind. I'll do that. And, we figure 5 years later, I had the first real taste of that. I continued to listen to the radio, and got more and more involved into music and knowledge-wise and enjoyed listening. And my musical taste expanded. When I was 17, I got my real first taste, and I really knew that this is something that I really wanted to do and apparently was pretty good at. Even at that age, with no real training, per se, except kind of just being someone that liked to talk. As I said on this podcast many times, I mean, I used to get very good grades in grammar school and high school, but my report cards were always tempered. I used to get very good grades. No complaints there in terms of grades, but always in that little comment section or that behaviors section. There was always a little X mark by talks too much or in other. If talks too much wasn't on there, then other was crossed, and it always said talks too much, which was also a hint to me that, well, look, if I talk too much, then maybe that's the way if that's something I enjoy doing or I like doing and I do it quite a bit, I might as well see if I can carve a career out of it. And looking at that radio, someone seemed to be that they were talking for a living. So that's what I want to do. I don't know if that's high or low on the terms of ambition scale. I didn't want to climb mountains. I didn't want to become a doctor. I didn't want to become a lawyer, even though I did go to law school for a year. But my heart wasn't in it. And once again, I was told I should... you'd be a great lawyer because, you can talk and you argue. You make good arguments. You handle yourself well in public. You'd be a good lawyer. Perhaps that was true. That's one aspect of that job, no question. But I just didn't have the passion for the whole job. I didn't have a passion for the law. And it is not an easy thing to get through law school. You can get through it. I could have gotten through it. It's designed not to be easy. It's designed to weed people out that maybe shouldn't be there. They go there for one reason, and then I was actually a result of law school being purposely difficult to weed me out because I didn't belong there. I thought I did. I was doing okay. I wasn't doing great because I just didn't feel it, you know? So, I totally knew that I wanted to be on the radio. And when I was 17 years old, I actually won a contest on one of the radio stations. Now my musical taste moved as I got into my teens. And from the AM stations, I was into FM radio and album-oriented rock and more rock and roll. And they played more than just the top 40. They played, you know, songs off the albums. Now we call them deep cuts or deep tracks. They were just, you know, called album cuts back then. And one of the most popular FM radio stations at that time was WLUP, The Loop. It was the place, especially, to listen to music around that time, rock music. It had been for at least several years, and they had a contest called the Chicago Star, and the whole idea was that you could host your own music show for an hour. You would come in to the station and record a show. You'd pick your own music off of their playlist. And you would be the DJ for an hour. And so to me, this was a really exciting opportunity because I would get to perhaps now, in my mind, I said, I want to do that. I'll do that. But I didn't know if I could do it. I had been listening to the DJs for, you know, at that point, more than half of my life. I felt that I could do it. I was learning. I was going to school every day by listening to the radio of how to do it, but I never had a chance to do it. I'd spoken in public. I've always been very comfortable performing, if you will, but being in front of people, talking, giving a speech, reading, performing, whatever it is. I've always felt comfortable in that. I was never the class clown. I think of myself as the class comedian or the class critic or the class observer. I was never a class clown. I went for laughs, no question about that. But I didn't do that by making goofy noises or pulling pranks, or doing that kind of stuff. I still can't do the arm, you know, that sound that like sounds like passing gas, like when you put your hand under your armpit and you pump it. I didn't do that. That was too low. Even when I was like 12, that was too lowbrow humor for me. I was more observational. I was already, more in the George Carlin, Jerry Seinfeld mode than just the slapstick Three Stooges. Never a fan of the Three Stooges. I couldn't tell you one episode. Never watched the Three Stooges. Never got into it. Not a fan of slapstick. Always a fan of well-crafted jokes. That's why I'm such a fan of the Honeymooners. Because, yes, it's a very loud show. Ralph Cramden is big and loud. But if you listen to the writing and some of the lines, they're so clever. They're so cleverly crafted. And so that's where I got my education in many ways. So this idea of entering this contest and hosting your own show on my favorite radio station was just, wow, I got to do this. And you sent in a letter. It wasn't all that difficult. You sent in a letter and you just explained why you should host the show. And so I did, and they called me, and I went in. I went downtown with my mom, and we went to the studios at WLUP at the time in the John Hancock Center, which was very cool, especially for a 17-year-old kid, and went into the station. I mean, I've been listening to this place on the radio, and back then there were no cameras in the studios, folks. This was all theater of the mind back then. You only imagined what the people on the radio looked like, and you only could imagine what the radio station looked like. One of the great informational things was seeing the movie American Graffiti, because if you remember, a main storyline in that was Wolfman Jack, the the disc jockey who played the music that played such a major role in that film, almost like a character. And it was one of the characters, the Richard Dreyfuss character, wants to see Wolfman Jack, who was the most popular DJ, and everybody listened to him, and he wanted to dedicate a song to this mystery girl that he had seen in a car, and he couldn't figure out any way else to find her except to send out a message to her via the radio through Wolfman Jack. And so he goes where the studio, he finds out where the radio station is and goes there and talks to a guy and says, "Hey, you know, I'm here to see the Wolfman." And this guy is eating a popsicle and he says, "Nah, well, you know, the Wolfman isn't here right now, but I'll pass your message on to him." And he's talking, you know, a normal talking guy and just kind of sitting there moping around, like, maybe, you know, just kind of taking care of the station. It's late at night. There's no one else there. He's by himself. And so the Richard Dreyfuss character is very disappointed because he wanted to talk to Wolfman and ask him to play this song for the mystery blonde girl, who, of course, if you don't know that or not, wound up being a young, unknown Suzanne Summers. She never even had she had no lines. She was just seen a second in the movie in a car, and she gave a smile. But that was probably one of her first major roles. So anyway, the Richard Dreyfuss character is very disappointed. He didn't get a chance to meet the Wolfman and tell him how desperate he wanted him to play this song to find this girl that he was just madly in love with. She smiled at him, and he was looking for her all night up and down the streets of the town. And as he's leaving, he looks back into the studio, into the window, and realizes that low-key guy that had a normal talking voice and said, "Sorry, Wolfman's not here, but I'll pass the message on to him." Very low-key guy. He realizes that is, in fact, Wolfman Jack, because he sees him on the mic and he hears him and he sees that he's become Wolfman. So it was like this image of who Wolfman Jack was, they didn't know. They just heard this voice. "Hey, baby!" You know, they just heard this voice. And so they created this superhuman, elevated version of some guy that was Wolfman Jack, the coolest guy around. And but in reality, he was just a regular guy like anyone else. And, you know, he's working the overnight shift. And Richard Dreyfuss's character did meet him and did talk to him and didn't think much of this guy at all. And he was just eating a popsicle, wasn't dressed cool, you know, didn't have the booming voice. He was just kind of low key and just like any other person you see on the street. But then when that microphone was on, he turned into Wolfman Jack, and you could see that Richard Dreyfuss kind of gave a smile. So it's a really it's a very pivotal scene in the film, and a poignant scene. And once again, it illustrates what I'm saying is that, you know, 50 years or so ago, nobody knew what people on the radio looked like. It was all about imagination. And nobody even knew what a radio station looked like. And I just remember going in there when I was 17 years old on a Saturday morning to record this show. And I walked in, and they were very nice, and they walked me around and let me see the studios. And and I saw someone on the air talking, you know, on Saturday morning. They were doing, you know, their show. And I saw that, and that looked really cool. There's this guy, I don't remember who was on at the time, but, you know, there's the microphone, this big giant microphone, probably the biggest microphone I ever saw. And surrounded by, you know, records, like in the studio itself, there were giant, you know, bookcases filled with albums, because back then, you know, we were still playing vinyl. This is the early 80s. Still playing vinyl. There were no CDs yet. It just looked cool. It looked really cool. There was this window, and there he was. And I felt like Richard Dreyfuss in many ways, watching, you know, when he saw Wolfman Jack be Wolfman Jack. I'm like, well, there's the guy. And I could hear the voice over the speakers in the hallway, and I could see that it was a little delay. And so he was talking and his voice was moving, and then the voice was coming, and it was just so cool. And I was like, okay, now I know I want to do this. And then when I actually went into the studio, a production studio, to record my Chicago Star show, Then I learned something new there, that a lot of the individual songs, yes, there were albums, because the disc jockeys back then had some freedom to play some of the songs, but the songs that they would play on a regular basis, on a regular rotation, they had on these things called cartridges or carts. They looked like 8-track tapes. Same look, same kind of technology, although I don't know if you can call it 8-track technology, but at the time it was. But it only had one song on it, just enough tape for one song. And so this way, that you didn't have to go and put the find the song on the album with the needle and cue it up. You just put a card in, and there was the song. It was once you hit the button, it started immediately. That's the way it was recorded on there, to start right away. And that's the way you know those songs were kind of tight. When one song ended, another one started back then. There were just a nice little flow, or they call a segue, from one song to the next. Well, that's how it was done. And so once again, I was like, wow, this is cool. And so basically, the guy that was helping me, his name was Dr. Don. I think that was his name. And he was actually an intern, but this was kind of his job, you know, to take care of the Chicago Star Show. And so, who was Don Dockman? I think his name was Dr. Don Dockman. That was the nickname they gave him. No, not sure whatever happened to him. But anyway, so there, and so these carts were in these little like twirling carousels, wire that you would stick them, then they would fit in. So this way, you could just spin them and look up and down. And you know, there was a label on the end, just like on an 8-track tape, and you would just see the song. So he'd say, "Go through these. You know, here's some of our most popular songs," or whatever. And so use these. They wanted to use the carts rather than queuing up the songs. So here, go through this. And I'm not sure how many songs I picked for an hour with commercials. I mean, I don't know, maybe 10. So pick, you know, 10 or 11 songs, and we'll do this. And so I picked, you know, some of the songs that I wanted to play. And then we got to recording it. And so the whole idea is, you know, you talk about the music, you talk about the song, either coming out of it or the intro or the outro, as you say. And then in those days in rock radio, you would talk up a song, meaning you would talk while the music intro would start. And then you wanted to time it. So when your little rap was done, the vocal started, and it's called hitting the post. Because the post was when the vocal started. And so I knew these songs backward and forward, right? So, and I knew when they started and when the vocal would start. I knew as I would sing along with the songs. I'll never forget, I had this song by the Michael Stanley Band called She Don't Love You, which was a huge hit at that time. In fact, Michael Stanley just died a few weeks ago. And when I saw that he died, I was like, well, I played his song on my Chicago Star Show. And so apparently, we hit the song, and it starts with a sax solo, and it's kind of a rocking song. It starts with a sax solo before the vocal hits, and so while that was going on, I started talking, and then I stopped, and the vocal started, and this guy looked at me going, "Wow, that was great." He goes, "You should do this for a living," and I said, "That's what I want to do." And after that experience, I knew what I wanted to do. And that show aired in 1981 on Easter Sunday. So it's probably right. I should go back and see. It might actually be, 40 years? I didn't even think about that, even when I start telling the story. But right now, it may have been 40 years ago that I was the Chicago Star on The Loop. Because it was 1981, and it was around Easter time. I have to look back to see when Easter was in 1981, but it was on Easter Sunday, and in the evening, and like 9 o'clock at night or something, and for an hour. And I still have the tape, and I listen to it every so often. It's still a cassette, but I still can play it. And I'm like, you know what? I wasn't bad, for I've never done it, never having done it before, being 17 years old. But, you know, after that, I knew I wanted to do that. And that's when I went to school, to college, and I was looking for a college that had a radio station. I mean, I was very focused, and I wanted to go to a school that had a radio station where I felt that I can get on right away. Back then, a lot of schools did not have radio stations. That was not a common thing. And those that had radio stations, it was not easy to get on right away, like your freshman year, because there was only so many hours in a day, and there was a lot of interest in it, right? For those schools that had it, the people that wanted to be on it wanted to be on it. So there's a lot of interest. There weren't a lot of radio stations in colleges, those that had them, they were very popular because that's what the people were looking for, that were interested in getting into that profession, or at least seeing if they did. And that was my view, too. Okay, after this one show, I didn't say, okay, now this is – I knew I wanted to do it. I didn't know if I could do it. But I really wanted to find out, is this something that I am good at and that I do want to do? Because if so, let me find out now, because if I can't do it or I'm not really interested in it, I don't want to waste my time. And that was one reason why I wanted to get on when I was a freshman, as soon as possible, because I don't want to waste some of these places. Some stations, some of the bigger schools that had bigger enrollments, sometimes you didn't get on the air until maybe your sophomore year. You had to work at the station and kind of like that. And I'm like, I don't want to wait a year, waste a year. And then what if, because if I do want to get into another major, I need to know that. So that's when I went to a smaller liberal arts college here in the Chicago area called Elmhurst College, which now is called Elmhurst University. And they had a radio station, WRSC-FM. And in fact, I heard about that because one of my favorite disc jockeys at the time, growing up, especially around that time when I was in my late teens, was Terry Hemmert of WXRT. And Terry Hemmert went to Elmhurst College. And Terry Hemmert was on WRSE. So that's how that whole connection came. And I'm like, well, if she could do it, then maybe that's where I should go. And sure enough, I went to the radio station my first day of school. That was the first place I went to find out when auditions were. And I auditioned, played two or three songs, kind of same thing, talked up a song. I remember I played a Warren Zevon song. I think we only did one song, in fact. I chose a Warren Zevon song. I can't remember if it was Excitable Boy or if it was Werewolves of London, but in the words of John Lennon, or Ringo Starr, I believe. No, maybe it was John Lennon. I hope we passed the audition. And I did. I talk about this, I give you this little background, because, as I said at the outset here, for the first time in a long time, my college degree is coming in handy. And I say that because when I went to college, and I realized I wanted to get into the media in some way, obviously radio, but there's no exact path into the media or into radio. Everybody's story you talk to in any kind of media, everybody's story is different. It's not like taking an accounting, following a legal, career or a medical career or an accounting career where there's a way to do it. You take accounting classes, you go to college and you take those classes, you take the accounting exam and you become a certified accountant. And then, or in law school, you take the bar exam, or medical school, you pass the medical school tests. There's no way in the media, in communications like that, there's no path like that. You have to cut your own. It's very competitive, and it really does take a lot of drive and a lot of ambition, because you have to sort of make your own way. Now, the idea, most people, at least I don't know what it is like today in college. I don't have a child, so I'm not really sure, but back then, almost everybody took business administration in college. Now, nobody knew what that meant, but it certainly sounded impressive. And you have to remember that, 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot of people in my generation was kind of the first generation of their family to even go to college. College was still kind of people were going, well, am I going to go to college or not? Today, it's a given. But there was still a question of what people were going to go to college. Now it's like whether they want to go or not, they go. As we saw by Lori Loughlin's college scandal, it's just expected that you go to college, even if you really have no intentions of graduating or no real ambition to go to college, but you just, that's sort of your next step. But it wasn't like that. There were some people that went right into working. There's some people that went to trade school, or some people went to college. There were a lot of different paths that people took. But business administration certainly sounded very impressive. And it was a nice fall. It was a nice catch-all. Nobody really knew what it was. But it's like, okay, well, it sounds like you're going to be a very successful person in life because you're going to get into business. But they didn't know what that was, really. But my my major was communications. Well, what does that mean? Nobody knew what it meant. And it sounded like it was kind of a blow off. And it sounded like, you know, you were not going to be very successful in life because what's a communications degree? Look at Tommy over there. He's getting into business administration. Tommy didn't know what the hell he was doing either. But, you know, it sounded nice and impressed people at the holidays. So whatever. The heart of the communications degree was basically in the title, how to effectively communicate to others, to both a large audience as well as one-on-one interpersonal communications, as well as mass communications, and through all different types of mediums, learning how to communicate through writing, learning, obviously in my case, wanting to learn how to communicate verbally. How to communicate non-verbally. So there are many disciplines within that. Now you say, wow, you know, how do you create a, you know, it sounds like a blow-off major to me, Jim. But it really wasn't. Was it as hard as accounting or economics? Probably not, but that wasn't my interest. I didn't care about numbers. So why would I do that? But to learn how to effectively communicate, I thought, not only from a standpoint of a career, but I thought it would be a pretty good tool to have just in life. Because at the end of the day, we have to talk to one another. We have to communicate. If I'm going to go on a job interview, I have to learn how to communicate, right? I have to put my best foot forward, whatever kind of job it is. But the communications degree was always viewed as a blow off degree. It really was. But I have to say, in 2021, I believe of all those business administration people, of all those psychology degrees, all those whatever degrees that were supposedly much more prestigious and much more opening to opportunity in today's world, in 2020, the ability to communicate, I believe, is one of the most important skills to have, and clearly, it's a skill that few have. Because for the last 40 or 50 years, it was not viewed as important. But in the last 10, 15 years, we all have become communicators through technology. We all have become communicators on a minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day basis, whether it's texting to somebody, whether it's talking to someone on the phone, whether it's going on social media, whether it's writing an email, we are communicating. All those skills that we use today to get our message to someone else is what I studied when I was in college. What I believe we're seeing today is, the fact is, the majority of people in the world, not just in our country, in the United States, but in the world, do not know how to effectively communicate. And you say, Jim, what are you talking about? I mean, we're in a communication age. Oh, yes, technology-wise, we are. But if you look at the substance of our communications, you see how poor our ability to communicate is. Perfect example is on social media. In today's world, we are so divisive. We are so divided that we can't communicate with each other. We can only communicate with people who think like we do. If we put something out to the world, we get easily attacked by somebody. That's also a part of the art of communication, is the ability to look at both sides of something, to study what was written and to fully understand it, whether it was said or written. If it's poorly written, if it's poorly communicated, the message doesn't get there. What I point to, for instance, is I believe in the past year, our ability to communicate to one another, we receive an F. And I say that in connection with the pandemic. From a communication standpoint, the COVID pandemic has been horribly, horribly underperformed. We have failed miserably in communicating about the pandemic from day one. From the officials at the CDC, from the government, from the citizenry, everybody has done a horrible job of communicating. There have been mixed messages. There have been confusing messages. There have been outright false information that has been spread out there that people have believed. As Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the message. People believe if they read it on the internet, it must be true. We have seen how with foreign countries hacking into our social media and putting out fake stories or propaganda to influence one way or the other has been very effective because everybody believes what they read on the internet, on social media. That's what Marshall McLuhan meant by the medium is the message, in part. But we have done a horrible job of communicating. Everybody has. And if there's a takeaway from this, hopefully, there are many takeaways from the pandemic, but communication and the art of communication, and yes, there is an art, and no, it was not a blow-off 40 years ago, or 35, whatever it was when I graduated. It was not a blow-off. And I pride myself on my ability to communicate verbally and written. I don't just throw something on when I go on to the, if I make a post on Facebook, I carefully craft what I want to say. And I do so, and I don't just get done writing and hit send. I'll write something off the top of my head, and then I will continue to refine it. And then the most important part is I will read any posting, whether it's frivolous or not, and I will say to myself, how might this be misinterpreted? And if I find a way, if I believe it can, then I will re-edit again to make sure that this is conveyed in the way I want it to be so that my direct message is conveyed in a clear way so that it won't be misunderstood. Now, you cannot, at the end of the day, even with that kind of safety valve, you still cannot assure that your message will be received in the way it was sent. Because as I've said many times, everything looks good on a whiteboard. Everything looks good on paper until you add the human element. And we screw it up. We are a flawed species. And our logic is our greatest asset, and yet at the same time, we are the most illogical. And so many times, especially if it's a subject that you might be talking about that may be a trigger for people or is something that people are passionate about, they bring their own thoughts and their own biases and their own expectations to something that you may post online. And they read into that. They bring those, and when they read your message, as carefully worded as it may be, they bring their bias there. They bring their history there. They bring whatever baggage they have. They bring whatever opinion they have to that, and they view it through that prism. And they still may misunderstand what you say, because that's either a trigger for them, they've got a chip on their shoulder or something, or they perceive this, anything on this topic, as being, if you talk about this topic, if you don't say exactly what I think, you're wrong. That's today's world. Bad communication. But from the get-go, the COVID pandemic has been poorly communicated to people. Starting with the CDC, they have constantly sent mixed messages. They have constantly, and sometimes, I don't know if they don't mean it or not. In terms of the pandemic, everybody was learning as they were going. But they're still in our rush today, because we're so, you know, the internet is all about speed. In their rush to get stuff out quickly, they didn't take their time and they didn't think about how could this be misunderstood. So a lot of misinformation was put out there. They would contradict themselves a couple of days later. We had the president, President Trump was passing along information that really wasn't based in the truth at the beginning. To be fair, we've also learned that Dr. Fauci, who has been viewed as a straight shooter, right? He even has admitted that initially, in terms of masks, he was saying that you didn't have to wear a mask. And then later on, of course, now masks have been the key political issue. And this is something that President Trump actually, you know, in trying to discredit Dr. Fauci, said, well, he's been all over the board. That's true. And Dr. Fauci then later did backtrack and say, well, we put out this message that masks weren't mandatory initially because we were afraid that then everybody would go out and buy them, and essential workers, especially medical people who really did need the masks first out of the box, because they were going to be dealing with patients one-on-one right in their face. We didn't want the supply of masks to run out with the public getting them and not being able, for essential workers and first responders and medical people to have them. I understand the motivation. But you should have said that initially. You should not have said they aren't mandatory and then said they were. His goal was the right goal. We want to make sure that there are people that are going to really need the masks, have them first, so we don't run out of them. Nothing wrong with that. But it was deceptive. The CDC has continued to give mixed messages. Just this past week, within the same breath, they said, if you've been fully vaccinated, it's safe to travel. Then they said, you should not do any non-essential travel. Well, which is it? Terrible communication. If I need to think about that, if I need to go, what are you talking about? It's bad. No one raised their hand to say, are we making this clear? What does that mean? This seems to, how are we sending out these two messages at the same time? The problem is, and the first step, the first rule of good communication is the easiest of all. Know your audience. Know your audience before you're going to communicate, and then speak to them in terms that they can understand. I believe that a lot of the initial miscommunication and misinformation that has come out on this pandemic, which has led to where we're at today, when there are 17,000 different viewpoints on it. The reason is that there was miscommunication at the beginning, which allowed people then to bring in their own biases for them to believe stuff that they were reading that were coming from various sources that was contradicting that. They were hearing different things, then they were picking and choosing. They were hearing it from their friends and their moms and their and whoever, and there was suddenly there was a mass of information, and no one knew what was right and what was wrong. And that started at the beginning. That kind of communication or that kind of confusion didn't have to happen. If the initial information was clearly communicated and communicated in a way that it was speaking to its audience. And in this case, its audience was the American people. And I believe they got off on the wrong foot, and they continue to be on the wrong foot, because at the end of the day, we have doctors who are coming up with these guidelines, and they are forming them, and they are using medical speak. Just last week, I talked to you in my podcast that I misunderstood a doctor's message to me on my answering machine, which led to a night of a lot of stress because I thought there was something seriously wrong with my health, and it turned out it was exactly the opposite, that there was, but my doctor used the word dangerous. I misheard. I thought he said something dangerous. He said nothing dangerous. My view is, why are you using the word dangerous at all if the news is good? Don't use the word dangerous. Don't leave any chance for misinterpretation. To my point earlier, before you say this, before you write it, say to yourself, how can this be misinterpreted? And if I believe it can, let me change it and eliminate that level of misinterpretation. So if he's thinking in his mind, I'm going to leave this message, I don't see anything dangerous here. But you know, the word dangerous is a dangerous word. And maybe I won't say, if I say nothing not as clear, or maybe he's just hearing dangerous, don't use the word. If there's no danger, why bring that word in? Should have been some editing there. In this case, with the pandemic, we should have not been using medical terminology. We should have been using regular speaking terminology. For instance, I just told you, when asked the CDC, explain what does this mean? You can travel if you're vaccinated, but you shouldn't do essential travel. Well, suddenly it seemed as if one of the doctors said, well, there's no real conflict there. That's not a mixed message. By essential, we mean okay. Then you're using the term essential in a medical term as opposed to a real life term. Because in the real world today, in terms of travel, in terms of people seeing their loved ones, seeing their mom, their mothers and fathers in another state, seeing their grandparents in another state, seeing their children in another state, seeing their friends in another state, it's in many cases, if they followed some of the guidelines, it may have been over a year now they haven't seen these people, their loved ones. In their minds, after having been cooped up with COVID fatigue, is what we're hearing, it's called now, and it's accepted. When you say essential, a doctor, a medical expert may say, well, essential, in my mind, we meant to say, unless it's perhaps work-oriented or health-oriented, that's essential. But to an average person, after a year in quarantine, whether it's been a diligent quarantine or a loose quarantine, it still feels as if I've been deprived. It's essential for me to see my loved ones. It's essential for me to see my children. It's essential for me to see my friends. So if you say it's okay to travel if you've been vaccinated, And they, and then you say, but you shouldn't do any non-essential travel. The term essential now is vague because you're not using it. The people are not interpreting it, the word essential, as the way perhaps the medical community or those writing this directive thought of it. The average person is thinking about it, how it pertains to their own life. And yes, you know what? It's essential for me to get on a plane and see my mom and dad in another state, or to see my kids in another state. Miscommunication, mixed message, because you're not speaking to your audience. These guidelines are meant for the American people. They are not meant for business professionals or for medical professionals. They are meant for the lowest common denominator. I worked in public relations for 10 years. It was my job to communicate effectively on behalf of my clients and to make sure that my message got out there. If you notice, when I speak to you through this podcast, I use many of the communication tools that I've learned in my career. You might say, well, geez, Jim, it sounds like, you know, a lot of times you seem to repeat things. You say something two or three times, I notice, they may say. I've been told this. Yeah, I know you've said that already. Okay, but you know what? That's good communication. Because if you now know and remember what I've said two or three times, that means the takeaway from this conversation, you'll remember what I was talking about because I said it two or three times. Part of my job in public relations was media training. I would train people before they went to, they would do either TV interviews or print interviews or radio interviews. And that was part of your thing. You hear many times on the Sunday morning shows or the news people, you know, the news shows, they'll say, oh, well, that person was just saying their talking points. Well, they're referring to that person having been talked to by a communicator, being talked to by a media trainer to say, during this interview, here's our three key messages. And so you want to make sure that you say these three things as much as you can throughout that interview. Even if they don't ask you about them, you have to find a way to get them in. Because the goal is you maybe only have a minute and a half or 2 minute interview, and we want to make sure that we tell our key message about this new product or about this new guideline, whatever it is. We want to make sure that gets out there. And so here are some techniques to get that out. So here, when I'm talking to you on this podcast, you may say, well, Jim, you're just sitting around, you know, BSing for an hour. Well, certainly to some extent that's true, but I'm also doing it in a way that I'm hopefully communicating to you and making sure that when you listen to this podcast, when it's over, that you get the thrust of my message, of the key things that I wanted you to remember about this. There are techniques. There is an art to communication. Our society on the whole does not know how to communicate. That's why there is so much misinformation. That is why there is so much divisiveness. That is why there is so much, I didn't know what she was talking about. Because we have, for my lifetime, we have not put a high premium on the ability to communicate. However, we are now living in a society more than ever that is based solely on communication. And so I'm actually proud and happy that I believe that in the 21st century, in 2021, I feel very well equipped. I'm glad I had my major, because that business major or their accounting major and all those impressive majors that people were all impressed of, at Thanksgiving, they may have, helped people get jobs, no question. But in today's world, to just get your message, if you're texting someone or if you're writing to somebody in an email, the ability to communicate effectively is at a premium today. Because we are doing it throughout so many different areas, through texts, through emails, through Zoom, through any kind of written communication, through any verbal communication. So I'm actually feeling that I've got the last laugh. on my major. It may have felt like a blow off, and it may have felt like, oh, geez, what are you doing? Why even bother go to college for that? But, you know, now I'm glad I did. And as I said, and one reason why I brought this topic up was not only I'm happy that my college degree actually has now come in, it's actually, the rest of the world has caught up to me, apparently, and to the communications degree, so thankfully that. But I could see that when I post things on Facebook, I can see the level of deficiency that many people have in their ability to communicate. I posted something over the past couple of weeks about the film, The Ten Commandments. If you've listened to me on the radio, I think I've talked about it here too. I've always joked that the movie, The Ten Commandments, which was made 65 years ago this year, you know, when it was made, it was heralded as the greatest movie event in history, right? So there was a lot of pomp and arrogance about this movie to begin with. It's 3.5 hours. It had huge sets. It had thousands of extras. It was bringing to life the story of Moses and the Ten Commandments and the Jewish Passover. And so there was religious implications of bringing the Bible story to life. And Charlton Heston, there was a lot of melodrama, just it was all there. It was a very big, bloated kind of movie. Now, at the time, it was viewed as an amazing, you know, event and an amazing accomplishment to put this movie together. But as time has gone on, you can still appreciate the magnitude of it. But what's also interesting is in 65 years, it has also become unintentionally funny and amusing. The acting, in its effort to be dramatic and important, now looks overblown and almost comical. I've often referred to it as the most hilarious, unintentional comedy film ever made. Even though at the time, in 1956, it was expected to be and was not, considered at all a comedy, right? I mean, this was, in many people's minds, especially 65 years ago, where people's religious values were much stronger, many people looked at the Ten Commandments film as a documentary. It was almost as if, okay, this is what happened. There really was a fireball that was throwing, God was throwing fireballs at the rocks and writing the Ten Commandments. I mean, you know, wow, they say this really happened. I mean, that was the viewpoint back then. And if you believe that, I have no problems with that. I'm not making fun of the film or the story. I'm making fun of the film. I'm not making fun of the story. I'm not making fun of your religion. I'm making fun of a movie about religion. And I think that's fair game. I'm making fun of an entertainment entity, not a religious entity. I would make fun of the Ten Commandments if it was a 3.5-hour Western that looked silly 65 years later, or a drama, or whatever it is. It just happens to be about the Ten Commandments. Now, so I put on my Facebook page a couple of Saturday nights when it was on, if you're thinking of calling me, don't, because I'm watching the Ten Commandments, the greatest unintentional comedy film of all time. And most people got what I meant. And I put the word unintentional in there on purpose. As I said earlier, when I was writing that post, I didn't have unintentional there first. And before I hit save and posted it, I read it and I said, you know, I don't want to call it a comedy because people may misinterpret it that I'm calling the story of the Ten Commandments a comedy. And that's not my intention. My intention is to make fun and poke fun at, sarcastically, satirically, at the film itself. Not the subject matter, but the film itself, the overacting, the arrogance of the script, of the dialogue, of the acting, of the costumes, of the overimportance. Cecil B. DeMille one of the most self-important directors, always thought everything he did was historic. You can feel the arrogance in that movie. You can feel the self-importance of that movie, in the making of that movie. I'm not making any judgments about the story. That's your belief, and that's fine. I have no problems with that. I'm making fun of Charlton Heston's acting, of Anne Baxter's acting. Oh, Moses. The lustiest, most horny woman I've ever seen on film. I'm making fun of Edward G. Robinson's overacting. Where's Your Messiah Now? Even though he never said that, but Billy Crystal has made that into one of the greatest jokes. The costumes, the parting of the Red Sea, Moses coming down, Charlton Heston coming down from the mountain, gray suddenly. You know, these are all aspects of the movie making, not the story. We don't know what Moses said. We don't know what Edward G. Robinson's character, if he even existed, said. But in the movie, we do. So I believe that it's fair game to criticize the film on its merits as a entertainment vehicle, but I'm not making a comment on the story itself or the religious aspect of it. That's your belief. Well, there was one woman that took offense, and she was very passionate about it. And I understand, I appreciate her passion, but I believe it was misguided. It was almost as if you cannot criticize any movie because it's about religion. If it's about religion, whether it's well-made or not, it's off-limits because it's religion. Well, that may be a trigger for some people, but that doesn't mean that that's right. But I believe that when she read my comment, she brought her own triggers that anything about religion is off base, is off limits, and that I was making fun of religion, especially on the day before Easter. Not at all. I was pointing out how you can watch this film and actually look at it in a different way and to appreciate some of the, over time, unintentional comic aspects of it. In many ways, the film is an impressive achievement, but there's also aspects of it that haven't aged well. And one of them is the overacting. So I stand by my comment as an unintentional comedy. It certainly was never meant to be a comedy. But over the years, as acting techniques have also changed, and we're not that dramatic anymore, and we try to be more realistic, it does feel dated. It does look funny. It does look comical. When Yul Brynner says, "So it shall be written, so it shall be done," you know, wow, what a great line. But it's delivered in a way that I don't think in today's world you would say it that way. There is a sense of bravado and magnitude and self-importance behind almost every line of dialogue in that movie, to the point where it's actually now become comical. So this is my point. I believed that I was being very clear in my communication. I even did my usual self-editing to say, did I do this right? And I changed it. I put the disclaimer unintentional there in order to get the message across that I'm making a little satirical, sarcastic little joke here. But if people bring their biases to something, it still can be misinterpreted. But at least I feel I did my job, so that when she came back at me, I said, look, I'm trying to make a joke here. If I have to put a disclaimer in front of everything and explain before I make the comment, well, then all the humor's gone. There's no point of even making a joke. That's why in today's oversensitive society, we're seeing that a lot of smart comedy is not being done anymore. If you realize, most of our comedy today is very basic. It's very slapstick based. It's pranked and punked, and it's visual stuff. It's not about very well-turned phrases or smart observational things, because the average person isn't catching the irony or the satire or the parody or the sarcasm. They're coming at it with this sense of, if you say anything that I don't like, I'm offended. Well, comedy, to be the best comedy, has to offend. Because the best comedy is an elevated and exaggerated view of reality. So you take something and then you take it to another level, and to sometimes an absurd degree, and at sometimes perhaps even some kind of whatever offensive means today, because what, who knows what that means. But you can't really have comedy, at least verbal comedy, without potentially offending someone. Because you are going to say something negative or exaggerated. And if that person has some oversensitivity to your topic, they're going to attack you. Now, I was glad in that many people stood up for me and said, I know exactly what Jim was talking about. And when I did then explain and had to go into this disclaimer thing, it was dry, but I tried to explain myself to a few people that were seemingly offended by it. But I didn't apologize for it, because I didn't do it to offend anybody. I was doing it to bring attention to the comic aspects of a film that at one time was considered a drama. There's some irony there. There's some satire there. I really feel that we're losing a lot of our sensitivity or our sense of humor because of our lack of communication. Because the average person does not know how to effectively communicate today. Everybody's getting offended by everything. And if you don't fall in line with what either the majority believes on one side or the other, you are branded as something terrible. And that's where we have this cancel culture. I even wonder, in today's world, with how quickly offended people are, one thing, not only I think are we losing our sense of humor, I think we're losing our sense of individualism and our sense of boldness. That's a great word, boldness. I don't think today's society is appreciating or is acknowledging the idea of being bold. Being bold is to go against the norm. To do something that, or say something that is not in line with everyone else. But our boldness has been some of our greatest moments in the history of man. I wonder, if we had social media today, the social media that we have today, I wonder if we had the social media and the kind of divisiveness in the 24-hour news with their own biases, we know, Fox is far right. We know MSNBC is far left. We know that going in. The media today is biased. There's very little objectivity. Everything is subjective. Everything is told from a personal standpoint as opposed to a factual standpoint. And if I don't agree with you, then you're wrong. There's no middle ground. There's no discussion. I've gotten into discussions online with people, and then finally, I will give my opinions, and I will give my reasons, and then finally, I'll just say, look, we don't agree, and that's okay. I enjoy a spirited argument. I learn from it. Even if I don't think I was wrong on that, the other person may at least open my eyes and say, well, here's why I think you're wrong. And I'll go, wow, I never thought of that. And I will file that for the next time. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing. But there is something to being able to put your own opinion forward and then backing it up with facts, not rumors, but facts, and your own perspective on it. And it's okay to disagree, and maybe you'll learn something from that. But I think we've lost our boldness. I wonder if, because you're either right or wrong. This is right and this is wrong. I wonder if we ever would have gone to the moon in the 1960s, if we would have had social media to the extent that it is today. That was quite a bold statement that President Kennedy made, that we will get to the moon before this, we will ever get to the moon before the decade is over. He said decade instead of decade, which I loved. The decade with his Boston accent. But that was quite a bold statement that the United States in the space race with the Russians, we would get to the moon first and we would get there before the end of this century. And we did. We got there in July of 1969. He never lived to see it. But it was a bold statement to make. It was a bold initiative to continue by the predecessors of the presidents, of President Johnson and President Nixon, to continue that bold thing. And there was a lot of divisiveness on this topic, and there was a lot of pushback. Many people said, especially, don't forget, this was being told right at the beginning and the heart of the civil rights movement. Wait a minute. You're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, which back in the 60s was like, you know, billions of dollars. You're going to spend that for us to go to the moon, some dead planet, when we've got people right here on our planet who are starving, who need education, who are in poverty. If you're willing to spend all that money, spend it here. Why spend it at some dot in the sky? And that was a viable argument. And it was reported on the news. But back then, there was only three networks. There wasn't 24-hour networks to pound that message home or that kind of protest home. There wasn't social media to pick up that cause and say, why are we spending money to go to the moon when we're not spending it on people today? Those are all valid things, but my point is, we're getting to a point now where we are trying to homogenize everything so that everybody believes the same thing, that if nobody is audacious enough, if nobody is bold enough, if boldness is not appreciated and rewarded, how do we move forward? President Biden right now, in talking about his infrastructure program, used the word. This is the boldest initiative we have had in a century. We're going to redo our roads and our bridges and our airports in a way that have never been done before. And we're maybe going to help other people socially. But this is a bold move. And that's why it is being so debated. For its boldness, whether you agree with it or not, I'm not getting political here, but I'm talking about boldness in our efforts to be right or wrong, in our efforts to bring our own baggage to things, in our efforts to make a society that everybody believes all the same thing, which is impossible. I believe that we're also quashing our initiative, our boldness. People are afraid to say something bold. I shouldn't have been afraid to say that I'm going to be watching the most intentional comedy in all of all time, The Ten Commandments. I'm not putting this little comment on the same level as, going to the moon. But my point is, I guess you could view that as a somewhat controversial thing, because you're going to say someone may, who's very religious-minded, may take that offense at that. Well, I can't. I did what I can to make my point across, effectively communicating, saying unintentional. I believe I did my job without diluting my message or taking the humor, which was the main point of it, out. But I did at least believe, in my mind, I communicated it in a way that the humor and my non-offensive aspect of this should have been there. I said unintentional as a disclaiming word. But once again, it still made some people angry. But I don't know if we have to, we can't always worry about offending every person, because you're going to offend somebody. But if you communicate in such a way where you take the time to think about how somebody might misinterpret it and at least add a little more clarity, then maybe you can still be bold, still get your message out there, and perhaps not offend, or at least lessen the amount of people that you offend. You might always just be offending somebody with what you say, depending on what side they're on. But effective communication. When I went to college, it wasn't really valued. But I'm proud to say, in 2021, that I graduated with a communications major. And in 2021, I'm using it to its full extent. And proud to have been taking that, because in today's world, communication is the key. We need to talk to one another, folks, without screaming at each other. We need to better communicate. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Don't forget, every Monday a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com, or we are found wherever you go to find your favorite podcasts. Don't forget, send a link, send a message, tell your friends, tell your family that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and why isn't it theirs? Your loyalty and devotion and that little extra effort is much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 255. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen. Now that sounded pretty good. You understood that, didn't you?